Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Joel Beinan, professor of Middle East history at Stanford University, joins me to discuss the Biden administration's posture towards Egyptian President Sisi, despite his countless human rights violations, and what it means for the U.S.'s broader Middle East policy.
And Heather Digby Parton will help us break down all the top news items of the week. Hey, you can support this show by becoming a member by going to ROFpodcast.com. When you do, you not only help this show thrive and survive, but you also get extra content every week. This week, an interview I did with Spencer Ackerman, did a version of an interview with him on the Majority Report. We went in a little bit of a different direction this time around. He's written a really fascinating book that basically tracks our reaction as a country to 9/11 to the rise of Donald Trump. Really interesting. Looking back upon 9/11 20 years ago this weekend, obviously very relevant. So become a member today, ROFpodcast.com. And when you do, you not only get access to this week's extra content, you can go back in our archives and listen to our extra content for months and months and months. In fact, go back and listen to Ring of Fire shows for years. So check it out, ROFpodcast.com. Thanks for your support. So, Heather, obviously some big things happening this week. On Thursday of this week, yesterday, I guess I should say, committees in Congress began to do their markups on the reconciliation bill. Joe Manchin came out earlier in the week saying, I'm only going to sign off on $1.5 trillion, basically trying to, I guess, you know, further whittle down the $3.5 trillion that Joe Biden wanted and that had been negotiated in the Senate. Also, of course, there's been more fallout from the Supreme Court, essentially allowing Texas to gut Roe v. Wade. The federal government said they're going to sue. And Governor Abbott, I guess, though, to his credit, reiterated that rape is illegal. And they're going to stop all rape in Texas, which is good. It does beg the question, why have they waited till now? But there is progress in the sense that we have a Republican leader acquiescing to the idea that rape is illegal. That is good. That is a step in the right direction, I think, for that party. There are other things that we can talk about, but tomorrow is 9/11. And it is the 20th anniversary of 9/11, which I don't know if you find as sort of disturbing as I do in terms of 20 years having had passed. But I thought it would be a good time for us to reflect on this, because I don't know that you and I would be sitting here talking to each other were it not for 9/11. I would argue that maybe the election in 2000 also was a but for in this instance. But those two, the interplay between the Supreme Court and the way that it went down in Florida, essentially saying that George Bush is president, and then 9/11 happening, those two events ended up putting this country on a trajectory that I think, you know, I spoke with Spencer Ackerman. We're going to play that interview next week. He certainly argued that it delivered Donald Trump, I mean, among other things. But there's a whole host of things that I know that you and I have both, you know, been commentating on. You've been writing brilliantly on for over 15 years. What I don't know. I mean, we got to reflect on it because it's 20 years. But do you have any sense of, like, I mean, have you digested it in some way?
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, you know, it was a horrible trauma for the country. And, you know, you were in New York, I assume, at the time. I was in LA, but of course, like the rest of the country, you know, we all felt the wound, perhaps not as acutely as New Yorkers did, but we certainly felt it and knew that something really cataclysmic had happened. And I mean, for me, just as an observer of politics and also having been very, you know, the election of 2000, as you said, really catalyzed, you know, my, you know, involvement in politics in a new way. I mean, you know, we had the new technology coming in with the internet and blogging and that sort of thing. But suddenly, you know, I mean, the election in 2000 had me already, you know, completely on edge that something had gone off the rails. And then 9/11 happened. And, you know, while I didn't necessarily blame, you know, George Bush or the Bush administration for the act of it happening, the consequence of it seemed clear to me, you know, almost immediately that we were going to, because it was George Bush, because it was the Republican establishment in charge, Dick Cheney basically running things, which seemed very obvious to me in the immediate aftermath, that we were going into a direction that was going to be very, very hard to turn back from. And then, of course, we watched the media completely collapse as any kind of a countervailing force that might have asked questions, that might have pushed in a different direction, that might have actually tried to stop what seemed to me to be a runaway train from the very beginning. I mean, even in the first days, and we learned this fairly quickly, in the first days, they were already agitating to go into Iraq. You know, the Afghanistan, we talked about this earlier a couple weeks ago when we were talking about Afghanistan, that, you know, this, when, you know, the, when George Bush stood on the rubble there and evoked vengeance as the motivating factor for going into Afghanistan, essentially by saying, we're, you know, we're going to show them or we're, they're going to hear from us real soon. It was clear that we were embarking on a period of very aggressive, hostile war and violence. And, you know, it was understandable on a sort of human level that people wanted to lash out, but you expect more from a government, certainly a superpower that has the capability of doing vast, vast damage to anybody that they decide to unleash their, you know, vast military on. So, you know, from the very beginning, I felt agitated. And what we felt, you know, particularly with the media taking the stance that it did, I mean, it rolled with it without question. Thousands of people took to the streets to object to the protest, the pending war in Iraq, and they barely covered it or treated it as if it was some kind of a sideshow, despite the fact that it wasn't just in the United States, people all over the world.
Millions
of people everywhere, in places like Japan, you know, I mean, in Indonesia, I mean, there were people everywhere that were protesting. And, you know, most of our allies would refuse to go along with it. And yet the media pushed and pushed and pushed. And I think that the, out of that experience, you know, I mean, Spencer Ackerman's book is brilliant. And I think he has a really good point, I think, in this, in that he sort of says that this was what led us to where we are today. And you can see it even now with the, you know, the fatuous Donald Trump, you know, writing this week that, you know, if only Robert E. Lee had, you know, been a general in Afghanistan, we would have won. I mean, this is where this has brought us. So, you know, the complete, I mean, like I said, the collapse of the media, you know, now it's the complete collapse of our political system, which I think has, you know, that whole thing has led us to this point.
I would also add to that, and I had a conversation with Senator Russ Feingold on the Majority Report on Thursday of this week. Former senator, I should say, from Wisconsin. He was the only person who voted against the USA Patriot Act in the Senate. And I would add that there was not only a collapse of the media, but there was also a total collapse of the Democratic Party, to me. And I mean, he was talking about being in the caucus room and having people, well, I think he was referring specifically to Hillary Clinton, but others too, and John Kerry, come in and stand up and say, We should not be going into Iraq. We should not be voting for this authorization for war. And then walking out of that room and going and voting for it. And this complete collapse, there was no, I mean, the media was without a doubt incredibly complicit in this march to war. I mean, in a way that I don't think people really can fully understand today, because there was no, the internet was not what it is today in terms of a mechanism for delivering, you know,
right,
delivers some false news and some real news, but it simply wasn't. There was a very limited menu for people to get their information, at least in terms of mass media, right? I mean, there were some newspapers that were really quite good. I think it was the Mercury News or Knight Rider.
McClatchy,
yeah, excuse me. Yes, it was McClatchy, and that did some very good reporting and in the lead up to the war. And there were like structural things. Like I knew at the time, people may not remember this, but MSNBC at that time was largely a conservative outlet. They fired Phil Donahue. It was owned primarily by GE at the time, which also happened to be the world's largest weapons manufacturer. And the head of GE at the time was, I think, was it Smith or Welch? I can't remember who.
Jack Welch, I think it was.
And I knew people who were contributors at the time who would tell us that he would personally call down if there was somebody saying, you know, anti-war stuff on there. And so there were some very big structural things. But without the opposition party being in opposition, there was no hope. Like, you know, like this is the thing that I think the Democratic Party never has really fully internalized. It they did it during Trump, but it was almost an exception that proved the rule on some level, that if they're not providing opposition. And I think, you know, you and I talked about this in the context of impeachment. We both have experience in the film world, and we know, you know, we both have experience in the idea of communicating in pictures and in, you know, sort of creating a narrative between two things that follow each other in sequence. And if you do not provide, you know, the audience, as it were, and you know, I hate to reduce it to this, but broadly speaking, you know, very much of politics is about this. You can show a character taking an action, but the way that the audience gets a lot of its information as to how they should react comes from the way other characters in that scene react to that action. And if you do not provide a reaction shot to guide the audience, then that action will dictate. And the Democrats never provided a reaction that indicated to the American public that what is happening is wrong. Now, maybe they didn't do it because they had the same agenda as the Republicans. But, you know, I've talked to Russ Feingold, where behind closed doors, they said, I mean, it was really cowardice. It was political cowardice. It was political cravenness. It was an underestimation of the American public. It was a lack of courage, however you want to express it. And it ended up reverberating in our society in so many different ways, in our judicial system, in our politics, in our criminal system, in terms of the national security state. In so many different ways that it is really, really hard to sort of wrap your head around that alternative trajectory, or even like a less extreme version of one.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I mean, this was, you know, kind of, I mean, you know, I've lived through a tumultuous period in American life. I mean, it's nothing compared to people who went through the Great Depression and World War II, but nonetheless, you know, people of my generation, you know, we lived through a lot of stuff. 9/11 was a crucible, I think. It was one that really, you know, it first of all, it crystallized the polarization in our politics, despite the fact that the establishment Democratic Party, as you say, basically completely folded in the face of this national threat. And we're unable to, I mean, it was one thing to, you know, bring everyone together and sing God Bless America on the steps of the Capitol after 9/11. And people were, I mean, they had attacked the Pentagon. There was, you know, they had been aiming for the Capitol building. There was a lot of fear running. I understand all that. That's just human nature. I get it. But subsequent to that, I mean, this is a national government. This is something, I mean, this was what a lot of people considered to be, you know, an existential threat. I never did. It seemed like a massive terrorist attack to me, which is not about existential threats. It's about creating mass hysteria, which it did manage to do. And you expect the national government to be able to pull itself together and the media pull themselves together and recognize that this big trauma had to be dealt with in some responsible fashion. To me, it proved the opposite, that the United States, under that circumstance, completely lost its head, that the government lost its head, the media lost its head, the institutions failed across the board to handle that properly. What we saw was, you know, no wonder Osama bin Laden was clapping when he saw the results of what he did. And that's been kind of terrifying, to be honest. I mean, you know, and that's continued on when the morning after the election of Donald Trump, I remember feeling just this heart sick, just absolute, you know, I mean, it wasn't because Hillary Clinton lost. I mean, you lose elections, big deal. This was something else. This was kind of in many ways, a culmination of all of that and the terror that I felt. What happens if a 9/11 happens and this guy's in charge? We already saw what happened with the establishment Republicans in charge. What will happen now? And, you know, I mean, for all of Barack Obama's faults, and I had plenty to criticize him for over the entire course of his two terms, I never felt that about him. I didn't feel like he and his team were going to lose their minds and be unable to function. And this is what I felt. There's something in our system, and particularly among those people, the Republican establishment and the government, you know, the political establishment in general, that proved itself to be incapable, in my view. And, you know, this is a very powerful country, and it is very tempting for people to challenge it that way. We showed, the mystique is gone. Let's put it that way. I mean,
right. Yeah. I mean, let's take a quick break and we'll continue on with this conversation as the country is, you know, noting and marking in some respects the 20-year anniversary of the September 11th terror attacks, which, you know, by any reckoning, it seems to me, were wildly successful from the perspective of those who committed it. We'll take a quick break. We'll talk more about that. So, Heather, in the last segment, you made a really good point as we were talking about the 20th anniversary of 9/11. Very hard to believe it's been 20 years. That the idea, the durability, the success of a society, it seems to me, one of its measures is how hard it is to untether it from its best aspects, I guess. Right. And let's be clear. I think, you know, I mentioned Spencer Ackerman's book earlier in the interview you did as well, or our talk rather, which makes the case that 9/11 and in the wake of 9/11, the Republican Party was very successful in essentially using 9/11 and the subsequent suspicion of Muslims as a way of reigniting or reinvigorating, not to say that it was gone, but to sort of really weaponizing the thread that has been in American politics since its founding, which is a racism, you know, a white supremacy. And 9/11 was used to that effect. And, you know, another way of measuring it is, you know, how much does a terror attack, which has there was no existential threat to the United States, and it was clearly designed to get America to sort of like erode itself from within and extend itself too far overseas. How much does a country have the ability to withstand that type of attack and not lose its bearings or its moorings? And like you say, I can't imagine bin Laden. I mean, look, we know just from a pure sort of like a practical standpoint, in the weeks before the 9/11 attack, Osama bin Laden assassinated the leader of the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan. They sent somebody in there ostensibly to interview him, and the video camera contained a bomb, and it was a suicide bombing of this Northern Alliance leader, who would have been the major internal force in Afghanistan in fighting the Taliban, and would have presumably been helped by the United States after the terror attack. So bin Laden knew the Americans were going to come to Afghanistan.
Of course.
And that was clearly the agenda to, and America walked right into that and further. I mean, who knew? You know, I don't know if bin Laden in his wildest dreams would have been like, they're going to get stuck in Iraq, in Iraq for 20 years as well. And they're going to, but he knew that the way to get the country to do the greatest amount of damage that he could do to the country would be to get them to sort of like both extend themselves militarily and, you know, create things like the Department of Homeland Security, like arrest and imprison Muslims for, you know, on nothing but the fact that they were Muslim. And we can see that progression. Muslim, Barack Hussein Obama, he's not an American. I mean, we can see where this leads. And it really, I don't know if we are even past it today in many, many, many respects, it seems to me. I just don't think that we have. I mean, I think we were headed in the wrong direction entering into that period, but and one can imagine what would have happened if Al Gore had been president on 9/11. I think we would have gone to Afghanistan, but it's hard to believe we would have gone to Iraq, in my estimation. I just don't think that would have happened. If only because the Republican Party wouldn't have been on board with Gore's war in the way that they were with the Bush war. It's very hard, obviously, to go back and look at these alternative theories, but there also doesn't seem to be any broad understanding of what happened to the Democratic Party at that time by the Democratic Party.
Well, there's never been a reckoning with that. I mean, look, we had two elections, a presidential election, that was, you know, a hugely salient part of the election campaign. John Kerry and Hillary Clinton were both voted for the war, and both of them were tied in knots over that vote. And I don't know whether or not, I mean, we do know, I don't think anybody who voted, you know, that this would be a, you know, something that they would do in the future. But, you know, they're always fighting the last war. I mean, remember that the people who voted, the people in the Senate, we're talking specifically about the Senate, who voted for the Iraq war, were all presidential contenders. I mean, a whole bunch of Democrats didn't vote for it. I mean, I think over 30, I think, voted against the Iraq war. But the group that voted with the Republicans were all presidential contenders. Yes. And they were very concerned because the first Gulf War, there was a huge debate around that one, right, when George Bush was president.
And we should say the Democrats controlled the Senate.
Yeah. Oh, they did. Yeah. I mean, they could. Yeah. I mean, there was no, you know, obligation or anything. But, you know, in the first Gulf War, there'd been a massive debate. It was a highly contentious debate. And because George Bush, the first, he had what was considered, you know, a win, and it was such a great victory for America, and everybody loved him, and we came out of that, and we were done. The assumption was that if you voted against it, you destroyed your presidential ambitions. And, you know, Bill Clinton won in 92, largely because he wasn't in the Senate. You know, the other people who were running against him had all been part of this big debate. So they're always fighting the last war there. So I don't know how this comes out in the future and whether it will be exactly the same kind of thing. But it doesn't matter. When it comes to war and peace, when it comes to those kinds of things, honestly, it's very, very difficult for me to ever respect anybody who doesn't see the seriousness of that kind of a vote and take it purely on you know, on the their gut knowledge of right and wrong. And what you say about Russ Feingold and saying that Kerry and Clinton and the rest of them all knew it was wrong, but they did it anyway. I mean, that really is a disqualifier. It really is, because that's the kind of thing. And there's nothing more important that you know, our political leaders do than to start a war someplace. So, you know, that really is. And of course, you know, I mean, you look at, there was such hysteria, you know, in the culture, in our political system. I mean, I'm reminded that within days after 9/11, we had Jonathan Alter, a writer for Newsweek at the time, wrote a piece called, you know, It's Time to Talk About Torture. I mean, this was within days of 9/11. I think it was in November of 9/11. You had Tom Friedman in the New York Times writing that he was driving around Washington listening to the Battle Hymn of the Republic at top volume in his car, and thinking about how it was, you know, it was time to get payback. And, you know, in the run up to the Iraq War, he said that we should go in there and just really tell them what's what. I can't remember the exact phrase.
Well, it was actually 3 or 4 months. I know exactly what you're talking about. It was on Charlie Rose, and it was 3 or 4 months after the initial invasion. And he said we needed to go in there from Basra to Baghdad, kick down their doors at the butt of, you know, with the front of a gun, and said, you know, suck on this.
Suck on this.
Which part do you not understand? He was talking about popping the asymmetrical terror bubble or something to that effect. I mean, it was just sheer insanity. But yes, I mean, this was the people who were supposed to know better were the ones who sort of jumped on board to this, because everyone wanted to feel like they were being the ones who were sort of militaristic, and there was a very, I mean, it was a just a corrosive, cowardly time for a lot of people. I mean, really cowardly, in retrospect, and devastating, and in some ways sociopathic too. I mean,
yes. Well, the torture thing, I mean, just, and they actually did it. I mean, they actually went ahead and did torture. I mean, this wasn't just some guy writing a column popping off. I mean, this was an actual conversation that was going on, and that we now know, of course, and have known for some time, that we actually did. And which Donald Trump, by the way, ran on in 2016,
yep.
Ran on a torture platform. Not only will I torture, I will do much worse torture than they did before. This was this strain. It's a violent, you know, grotesque strain of sociopathy that was given, you know, some kind of a platform during this period.
It was never the legitimate pushback that should have existed. I mean, Donald Trump can go out and run on a platform of torture in part because Barack Obama, who, like you say, became president, certainly got through the Democratic primary because there was a, you know, there was a clip of him saying he was against the Iraq War when he was a state senator. And it was almost like he took his election as the repudiation. But no, he needed to do more in saying that we must hold the Bush administration to account. We must hold them to account for their torture. We must hold them to account for the lying that got us into the war. We must know very explicitly why it was we said we were going in there for weapons of mass destruction, and we had, you know, weapons inspectors on the ground days before we told them to get out so that we could bomb Iraq, saying, you know, please send us, if the CIA knows where these are, just tell us, we'll go get it. I mean, there needed to be an accounting, and it never ever happened. And so you this whole thing metastasizes. That's why you couldn't close Guantanamo, because there was never an accounting that there was a fundamental flaw in our response to the entire thing. And there still hasn't been. And which is why, you know, we get this I think the response to our withdrawal from Afghanistan. Or, you know, when Trump decided to bomb Syria, you know, there was nobody who was coming out and saying, hey, this is a bad idea, even though it was Donald Trump.
Exactly. And the media, they were out there saying, well, he became president today. They actually said that. This is when, he became the president today. And that became a joke, but that really was not a joke. That was, if Donald Trump wasn't Donald Trump and had handled his presidency more, like a sane person, that could have been the moment that he would have been considered the president. And they were all ready to jump right behind. This is what people have been yearning to hear. I mean, you heard this kind of stuff. There's always this default to the use of this, what do they call it? Kinetic violence. Yeah. In this military jargon, this idea that, this is that the United States is never more together than when we're, running off to war. I mean, I guess there's a certain kind of, aspect of human nature that does this, as I said before, but there is something very, very ugly and grotesque at the center of this in our culture and the Democrats, succumbing to the idea that they're somehow effeminate, which is really what, you remember people like Murdaugh, the Democrats are effeminate and, they went after John Kerry, who had been a war hero in Vietnam, for doing this, that again, it goes back to this narrative that Democrats have failed to adequately address and adequately explain to the American people why that is nonsense. And it's one reason why, for all of, Joe Biden's faults, whatever they may be, I still continue to admire the fact that he stood his ground
without a doubt,
because that is the most, it's the bravest thing I've seen a Democratic, politician do in a long, long time. He knew this was going to happen. They all did. That's why they were all cowards and why they all didn't do it before. And he did it anyway. So, I don't know if it'll hurt him. I don't know whether or not this is the end of Joe Biden because of it. But honestly, I don't care. I still have to admire the guy for actually doing this thing, because that was a brave act.
Indeed. Well, Heather, next week, we'll resume our discussions of, I'm sure, the reconciliation bill and other aspects of our politics, but appreciate your perspective on this.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks.
The Biden administration is receiving a lot of praise from the left, myself included, for withdrawing from our 20-year war in Afghanistan. I think rightly so, although the power structures haven't been as kind. However, the Biden administration's foreign policy leaves much to be desired in other areas, whether it's his posture towards Venezuela, Cuba, Israel. He's maintained the status quo, and in a less publicized, broader U.S. foreign policy failure, he's been propping up Egypt's dictator, Sisi. And here to talk about this is Joel Beinan. He is a professor of history and a professor of Middle East history, emeritus. And his piece in Jacobin is entitled, "The Biden Administration is Embracing Egypt's Dictator, Sisi." Joel, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Emma. And I should note right at the start that there's a co-author on that article in Jacobin, and that's Allison McManus.
Allison McManus, along with you, wrote a really great piece bringing attention to the United States' continued funding of Sisi's regime, which, of course, I think on the left, we focus a lot on the United States' funding of Israel. But Egypt, in terms of aid in this way, it's the second largest recipient of U.S. military aid, which I was unaware of. So that's pretty significant.
That's right. Since 1978, Egypt has received over $50 billion in military aid and $30 billion in economic aid. So it's no small number.
Certainly. And so let's just start here. We can talk about who Sisi is, just for a broader U.S. audience who may be unaware, and why he plays such a strategic, important role for the United States in the region.
So Sisi's position in Egypt goes back to the mass popular uprising of 2011. In February of 2011, Egypt's longtime authoritarian president, Hosni Mubarak, was removed from power. But in fact, that was as much a military coup as a popular revolution. And so the Supreme Council of Armed Forces came to be the dominant force in Egypt. Egypt then had its first free presidential election ever in 2012, and a Muslim brother, Mohamed Morsi, was elected president. And in order to make peace with the army, Morsi appointed Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who was one of the leaders of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, as his minister of defense. Morsi ruled for about a year, and the Muslim brothers did many things that made people nervous, especially women. And there was a campaign to remove him, which we later learned was substantially funded and planned by Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and military intelligence. Sisi was in fact removed by a military coup. Morsi was in fact removed by a military coup on July 3rd, 2013. There were mass protests against that, primarily but not exclusively by members and supporters of the Muslim Brothers. Sisi commanded a security operation in which at least 900 Egyptians were killed in August of 2013. And since then, he's been Egypt's strongman, ascending to the presidency in 2014.
How much of that effort by the UAE and Saudi Arabia was serving as some sort of proxy for U.S. interests?
That's not altogether clear. Certainly, they are very close allies of the United States. I think the American government was divided about Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brothers. The brothers made a big pitch to American businessmen. They invited a large delegation of American business people to Egypt and basically said to them, we're like you, we're businessmen. We believe in the neoliberal economic order. We're not confiscating any private property here. We believe in property rights. Capitalism is fine. And they were entirely honest in saying all of that. That is, in fact, the economic ideology of the Muslim Brothers. Many of their supporters at that time were major business people. But then there were others in the American government who said, no, Islamists, you know, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, not good, even though the brothers are not at all like them. So I think the United States was split, and therefore, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates stepped in and acted. They were very upset by the fact that the United States had allowed Hosni Mubarak to fall in the first place. And after the coup, and when Sisi was installed, then Secretary of State John Kerry was asked if this was a military coup. And he, because if it was
look
a coup,
over there.
if it was a coup, the United States has to end its military aid to Egypt. So he couldn't say that. So basically, whether Kerry and Obama wanted it or not, they were prepared to go along with it.
Right. And so then we begin Sisi's reign. So what has characterized his time as the president of Egypt as tyrannical and dictatorial?
Sisi is far and away the most brutal leader Egypt has had in the 20th century, maybe even going back to the early 19th century. Any expression of dissent whatsoever, even things which would apparently have nothing to do with state security or the stability of the regime, is smashed entirely. So recently, for example, two young women put videos of themselves dancing on TikTok, and they were thrown in jail and charged with undermining the morality of the nation. A young queer woman who waved a rainbow flag at a pop concert was incarcerated, tortured, and abused. She finally got out of jail and went to Canada, but committed suicide because she was suffering from PTSD. Mohammed Sultan, a joint Egyptian-American citizen, was jailed because he was charged with participating in the August 2013 demonstrations. He went on hunger strike for over 400 days. President Biden actually mentioned him in his campaign speeches. And subsequently, Mohammed Sultan was released, although his family were jailed and his father remains disappeared. So in particular, because President Biden had mentioned Mohammed Sultan and Sara Hagazi, the young queer woman who committed suicide, people thought, oh, well, he is, in fact, going to hold Sisi to account. Biden said no more blank checks for Egypt. But that isn't how things have gone.
So for people who might be unaware of Egypt's role in the region, and I guess maybe even, well, I'll begin here. Would the United States be giving this blank check, which is what it is, to anybody who was leading Egypt based on the strategic value of Egypt in the region because of the relationship we have with them? And also, for example, the relationship Egypt has with Israel at this moment?
More or less. That aid began under President Anwar Sadat. It continued for 31 years under President Hosni Mubarak. It didn't stop when Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim brother, was elected president, even though it made some people nervous. And of course, it continued full force under Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. The wrinkle in the Sisi years, where human rights violations have simply skyrocketed out the roof, there are an estimated 65,000 political prisoners in Egypt today, many of whom have not been charged with any crime. So the wrinkle is that Congress, noticing this, said, okay, Egypt gets $1.3 billion a year in military aid. There's no more economic aid. Let's hold back 300 million of it, unless the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, now certifies that Egypt has made certain human rights improvements, or if he says that it's necessary for the American national interest to give that money anyway. So every Secretary of State before Blinken, when that condition has been in place, has waived it and said, yeah, giving the aid to Egypt, it's necessary for national security. No Secretary of State has been brazen enough to come to certify that there have been any improvements in human right. rights behavior.
Well, that's the way things go, right? Saudi Arabia, our relationship with Saudi Arabia is instrumental to our national security, aka our capitalist interests, having access to their oil fields. So in terms of national security, like, I'm not necessarily seeing a specific capitalist interest at the forefront of my mind. I'm asking you, what is necessary for United States industry for us to turn the other cheek or look the other way when it comes to these blatant human rights violations?
So there are, of course, American investments in Egypt, and there's the Suez Canal, which has important economic as well as strategic significance. But actually, it's more than military strategic. Under former President Hosni Mubarak, his spy chief, Omar Suleiman, was known as the torturer in chief because he was instrumental in operating black sites where people who were picked up in Afghanistan and elsewhere during the war on terror were whisked away and tortured, and who knows what happened to them. And Egypt was just peachy keen to collaborate with the United States on that. Egypt is also collaborating, continues to collaborate in all sorts of anti-terror operations. Of course, Sisi considers the Muslim Brothers to be terrorists, which by and large they are not. So he's a little bit narrower, but okay, we don't mind if he puts some Muslim Brothers in jail and tortures them and so on. But when it comes to ISIS or Al-Qaeda, or who knows what's going to be the story with the Taliban going forward, Egypt is going to be right there. Egypt is also instrumental in keeping the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip surrounded. Israel has, since 2007, put a siege, a blockade on the Gaza Strip. So 2.1 million people are totally surrounded on three sides by Israel, but on one side by Egypt. And Egypt cooperates very nicely with Israel doing that. The two militaries talk to each other all the time. I mean, there is a peace treaty, of course, since 1979, but the relationship is quite warm, despite periods of tension as a result of regional affairs.
We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to expand a bit more on Israel's role in this continued relationship. We'll be right back. So before we broke, you were just beginning to touch on the strategic role that Egypt plays in the continued subjugation of Palestinians, and how the United States is propping that up as well. Like, to me, the military aid given to Egypt, you can see it, I guess, in part as a continuation of military aid to Israel, right? Because Egypt allows for them to be, for the perception of legitimacy in discussions with Palestinians, because they are an Arab partner in these conversations, even if they are on the side of Israel and thus on the side of the United States. Is that an unfair characterization?
No, that's more or less correct.
Okay.
I mean, in the beginning, when Egypt began to receive the aid with the signing of the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty in 1979, the idea is, well, Israel gets at that point $3 billion, today $3.8 billion a year in military aid. So if Egypt is going to be another U.S. ally in the region, we have to do something for them in order to prove to them that that this is a real relationship. Maybe the Egyptian army can be helpful to the United States in the region, because 1979, that was the year of the Iranian Revolution. It was uncertain what was going to happen, and would there be more Islamic revolutions? There was a lot of anxiety. As it turns out, by the mid-2000s, early 2010s, the American embassy in Cairo had concluded that the Egyptian army is no longer capable of combat. That they just get these toys to play with and they don't know.
Well, they're capable of torture for our own ends. Hooray.
Yes, torture requires much less skill than actual combat with aircraft and tanks and so on.
And much less money.
Yes. So the purpose of giving the military aid has at this point nothing to do with Egypt's military capacity or what it might do in that way for us. But as you said, Egypt was and is the most prominent Arab party, which is in an alignment with Israel against Iran, against Syria, against Hezbollah, against Hamas, the forces which call themselves the Axis of Resistance in the Middle East, although that's a very problematic characterization because Iran and Syria are themselves brutal dictatorships. So it's not only Egypt now. For a long time, it was Egypt and then Jordan. But Jordan is embarrassed about being in that place because the regime is very weak and half of Jordan's citizens are Palestinians and they don't like this at all. But last year, with the Abraham Accords, the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain signed on to full recognition of Israel, followed by Morocco and followed by Sudan, which was had its arm twisted because it was so deeply in debt and needed a loan from the International Monetary Fund. And the United States promised to take it off the list of international sponsors of terrorism if it would open relations with Israel. So now there's a whole crowd of Arab countries. Egypt is not alone, although it is, politically speaking and symbolically, the most important of those countries.
And so colloquially for a lot of people, or just I guess maybe colloquially isn't the right word, the dominant discourse when looking at how Egypt is relative to Israel and Palestine is that, oh, they brokered peace, right? They brokered peace between these two equal parties. And I find that to be frustrating because essentially, much like we talked about earlier, it seems as though Egypt is really just acting as a proxy for United States interests and helping entrench Israeli hegemony as relative to Palestine, because I understand the value in getting more Arab partners to recognize Israel and not, you know, threaten Israel, even though I think sometimes that's overblown given the fact that the United States would certainly respond. But in terms of the continued apartheid, it seems to play an instrumental role, and that would be quite troubling to me as somebody interested in, you know, seeing some Palestinian rights respected.
Yeah, I also would like to see Palestinian rights respected. The beautiful thing about this from the point of view of the United States is that Egypt is doing this in the name of its own interests. So the Sisi regime hates the Muslim Brothers. Hamas grew out of the Gaza Strip branch of the Muslim Brothers. So from the point of view of the Sisi regime, Hamas are the Muslim Brothers. We don't like them in Egypt. We're persecuting them, throwing them in jail, torturing them in Egypt. And if Israel would like to bomb them every few years and otherwise make their lives miserable in the Gaza Strip, putting aside for the moment that not every single person in the Gaza Strip is actually a member or even a supporter of Hamas, then fine with us. I mean, that's just good for Sisi's understanding of what Egypt's national interests are. And since it's good for the United States regionally that Egypt is the most powerful military in the region between Morocco and Pakistan, so everybody is happy, except the Palestinians are very unhappy.
Right. And lacking in healthcare and clean water and basic political determination and rights, but that's a whole separate conversation, though. Some of the blowback from this might be just that, as you mentioned earlier, that Iran and other nations are forming an axis of resistance and some sort of pact. Does this not just further entrench the region as being either you're on the United States' side or you're very much hating the United States? And I don't know what middle ground there is, because it seems like there is none.
There is a tiny middle ground. And that's Qatar, which is a country of 300,000 people, plus 900,000 non-citizens who do all the work.
That's a pretty tiny middle ground. That's a middle sliver.
Right. But Qatar happens to share with Iran the largest pool of liquid natural gas in the world. So Qatar is not happy with a total assault on Iran, because that harms its own interests. And for people who can watch Al Jazeera Arabic, not Al Jazeera English, you can see how they don't promote Iran, but neither do they go gung-ho in trashing Iran as, say, Al Arabiya, which is the Saudi-sponsored satellite TV network, does. So it's actually the Saudis. Until the Trump administration, let's say, until the Trump administration, it was the Saudis who were the most gung-ho in putting together what I would call a Sunni anti-Iranian axis, which accidentally or on purpose Israel was welcomed into. So they're not Sunnis, of course, but fine. They have an excellent army and good intelligence, and they sell us all this digital spyware that allows us to oppress our own citizens in addition to other things about Iran. So it was the Saudis, and actually even more than the Saudis, possibly the Emiratis, the United Arab Emirates. I mean, they are the engineers of this strategy. When Donald Trump came into office, well, lo and behold, Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, has lots of business relationships in the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, and all of his friends there tell him, yes, absolutely, abandon the nuclear deal with Iran. Let's gung-ho for war with Iran. And the military restrained Trump. He might otherwise have actually done it, which would have been a disaster for the entire region. So Israel is still pushing for an American military confrontation with Iran. They would rather not do it themselves. They would rather the United States do it. The Israeli military keeps on telling the civilian political leadership, no, this is not a good idea. Don't do this. Iran doesn't have nuclear weapons. Iran isn't trying to get nuclear weapons. But particularly under former Prime Minister Netanyahu, who was removed in disgrace because he's indicted on three counts of bribery and other criminal activity, Netanyahu was very, very much in favor of confrontation with Iran.
Well, that's a whole nother can of worms. But unfortunately, I mean, fortunately for us, I do believe that the Biden administration is very disinterested in a conflict with Iran, unlike the Trump administration, which was, you know, we were just talking about some of these wonderful people who are back on cable news to talk about Afghanistan, H.R. McMaster and John Bolton. Both were quite eager to re-engage with Iran. But it shows, one, the power that Israel does have in this region. I mean, Netanyahu did that whole PowerPoint presentation where he claimed that Iran was cheating on the nuclear deal. And as far as we know, there's really zero evidence to suggest that.
None.
And he was successful in getting the Trump administration, who already wanted to do this. One, Trump, from an ego perspective, wanted to tear up Obama's signature foreign policy achievement. But two, they wanted to get in conflict with Iran from the start. And luckily, we haven't gotten to that point. But largely, I would think that that's more Iran's doing. They did not retaliate in the way that they necessarily could have. And we're kind of lucky in that way.
I think you're right. Iran has been remarkably restrained, especially because Israel keeps attacking it digitally and so on. Iran did attack an Israeli ship not too long ago, but compared to the various forms of assault and assassination that Israel has unleashed against Iran. And we should also note that the United States assassinated Soleimani, the commander of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. So that's not a small thing either. But then my original take was very similar to yours, that the Biden administration wants to get back into the nuclear deal. And Iran's answer to that was, fine, let's just go back to the status quo ante. But then the Biden administration kept on introducing new conditions. No, we want to extend the deal to missiles. Well, the missiles were not in the deal at all. It just wasn't that. And Iran answered, okay, let's go back to the original deal. Our problem is we don't trust that you keep your word. So let's try to start back where we were. We'll see if you keep your word. If you keep your word, okay, then we can talk about the other things, which seems very reasonable from my point of view.
Yes.
The Biden administration stonewalled that. And so it's not at all clear that there is going to be a re-entry of the United States into the joint agreement, especially because the United States is now abandoning the Middle East in many respects and turning toward China.
Well, right. And that's why, so again, in isolation, the praise on Afghanistan is important, right? Except that it's a pivot towards China. It's a disinterest in re-engaging in the Iran peace deal, which I think is really important. And then let's bring it back to Egypt kind of as we begin to wrap things up. There seems to be, outside of the outlier that is Afghanistan, this extreme disinterest in changing any status quo foreign policy outlook from Blinken and Co. and the West exec people that populate the Biden administration's foreign policy team. Like, we are going to maintain, and that's about it. And the empire is going to continue, and we're not going to necessarily shift things in any discernible way. And that seems to be what you are anticipating in terms of Egyptian military aid.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. Joe Biden has been a liberal imperialist since the day he entered government service. He's been in favor of every ill-considered war that the United States has entered into. He was in favor of invading Afghanistan. He was in favor of invading Iraq. He's been wrong on all those things. We could list another whole other set of things he was wrong on, too. Even as vice president under Obama, to be fully fair, he was in favor of withdrawing from Afghanistan, not because he thought we never should have been there in the first place or that it's a bad thing for the United States to invade countries and destroy them, but because he saw that the United States cannot accomplish what it claims is its purpose there, and we're just going to lose American lives, which is what he's primarily concerned with, but also hundreds of thousands of Afghani lives along the way as well.
Right. And so you don't really anticipate a change with Egypt here, despite rights violations. I mean, they're not changing with Saudi Arabia. Why would they change with Egypt?
No. So there is now an Egypt lobby or caucus in Congress. And I think about 30 members of the House and Senate, they are the ones who are pushing for this $300 million to be held back until Egypt improves its human rights record. My expectation is that even though they mean that they've been trying to do this for some time, that Blinken will overrule them and say that it's a national security requirement. That's my expectation. I hope not. My co-author on the article, Allison McManus, is probably somewhat more optimistic than I am on that question. But I don't expect, I expect Egypt to get the full $1.3 billion.
Well, it's not fun broadcasting to agree, but unfortunately, I agree with you. I remain as cynical as I was when Biden eventually got elected, but we will see. Hope springs eternal. Joel Beinan, Donald J. McLaughlin, Professor of History and Professor of Middle East History Emeritus, and his piece in Jacobin is entitled The Biden Administration is Embracing Egypt's Dictator, Sisi, along with his co-author, Allison. Thank you so much for your time today, Joel. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Emma.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, are you still subscribed to the free show? Head over to ROFpodcast.com. Support the show by becoming a member. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And you can check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day and also in-depth interviews. You can find Emma and I on the Peacock app as well. Check us out at 5 p.m. and 10 p.m. daily. For Emma Vigeland, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.